Okay, now we are.
So I should mention that my wife Kayla and I had a calendaring snafu, and she scheduled something for the same time at which our daughter needs to be dropped off for a play date. So I'm going to have an hour on video, and then I'm going to call in just with my headset and take care of bringing her where she needs to go. But I won't be participating for the second hour. I'll just be kind of listening in the background, as long as it's safe. You know, I'm not. And
but you're kind of leading the second half, though, aren't you?
Well, that's why I wanted to say it up front, so that perhaps we could adjust how we order things or sequence.
All right, let's start with that and then do the second part. Okay, that's fine.
Is that all right?
Yep.
So we're doing chapter 7 first?
Yeah, we're doing chapter 7 first.
Yeah. Are we going to get started? Or
is yeah, we should get started, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny when we say we're doing a chapter?
Right. I actually don't like that framing, because as I was preparing for this meeting, I was looking back at both chapters, and I was finding a lot in the previous chapter, chapter 6, which we started on last week, that I felt attracted to, that I wanted to in some way bring into the mix, in some way work with. And I posted yesterday to the forum, to the topic for this call, that that I had in mind some kind of a movement, exercise or experiment. I had the vaguest idea of what that might be. And a more concrete conceptualization did not occur to me until about 15 minutes ago. So I'm not sure if it would work, but I'd like to propose it and see what you all think. There are a number of other directions we could go in as well. Chapter 7 is, I think, interesting because of the way that it contraposes depression and activism and communication as the mediating kind of term there. But I'm not sure. I think it might be more interesting to do this.
I also plan to do an exercise for chapter 6.
Okay.
It's a brief one, but just to let everyone know, and I support you 100% in doing what you're doing. If we want to do something experiential, I just want to let everybody know this is what we're going to be doing. And I love the framing of doing. I'm a doer. I like to live things. I like to touch things. I like to move. So I just want to offer that as a difference. I hope it makes a difference. But great.
Okay. So let me describe it first and just make sure that it makes sense at a conceptual level. And, you know, if it falls apart, then we could go in another direction. So we're in the act and we're on the move. And I was moved by this idea of carrying a feeling. I never quite thought of it that way. I like the phrase carry on. It's this sort of, you know, keep your chin up and keep moving. It's sort of a British, phrase that might be, you know, offered. Carry on, something like that. But carrying a feeling and then carrying it in language really, to me, speaks to the kind of the becoming of continuity that Erin refers to at one point. I think this might be in chapter 6, actually, and she's kind of reversing something that I think Whitehead said, the continuity of becoming. And so the idea was, we've also been talking about fields, and the field or the group subjectivity is a theme that comes up in chapter 7. So we have this idea of chaosmosis and the autistic perception, kind of pre-chunking of reality into distinct, you know, objects and categories. And there's something in that experience that I think Erin is seeking to bring into relief, not because, like, you know, as far as I, none of us here are autistic. None of us are, as far as I know, right? Disabled, quote unquote, disabled in that particular way, that we could really be in the body of an autistic person. But what I think Aaron, and I watched this documentary last evening, Wretches and Jabberers, which really illustrated for me what she's talking about, because it can get very theoretical, but when we have the concrete kind of examples, like Doug, you were also communicating about in your forum post just a few minutes ago, which I read kind of quickly, there's, you know, it brings it to life. So I think the idea is, I think what she's getting at here is this kind of alliance between poetic expression and artfulness and the ways that we can use language, be in language, express ourselves through language, an alliance between that and this, what she calls autistic perception, not just she calls it, but what comes through in the documentary and the writings that she shares by Lucy Blackman and others, autistic perception. So how do we sort of feel into that? Like, how do we sort of feel into that chaosmotic space that I think is so generative? And, you know, I have not read a lot of Deleuze, I've read very little, but I get this sense that he's kind of, my initial understanding is that he's wanting to liberate desire, that generativity of primary desire from pure experience, and kind of give that, kind of shake that out of the framework of capital or the framework of neoliberalism. I'm bringing in a lot of themes here, but it's sort of a chaosmotic mix. So the way I thought that perhaps we could kind of get into this space would be through an experiment called carrying the field. And I thought that we could try to play with not just movement, but also typing. Because this is another theme that comes in. I mean typing as in literally typing on a keyboard. One of the things about the people in the film and that she describes in chapter six is that their bodies don't do what their will wants it to do. So like the vocal cords that would normally articulate language as it flows into my mind don't actually articulate that language. And so there has to be a kind of facilitated process that can include another person, can include technology, but that thought has to translate into words on a screen that other people can access. And, you know, autistic people, I'm just learning this, like through reading this text, documentary and other sources, can go years, decades even, having thought, having awareness, having intelligence, but not being able to communicate it. So not being able to carry the feeling through the language into the world, not being able to bring it forth. And again, this is part of the reason that I felt quite struck by this, is because I feel as a poet that I have gone years and years trying to carry a feeling, trying to bring a thought or bring a feeling into communication, into language and into expression, and not being able to do so. Being stymied, being stuck, being paralyzed in various ways. And I'm otherwise a neurotypical and a able-bodied person. But I have this experience, which I think is, you know, similar to, in a certain way, that I think Aaron is describing, that has these kind of characteristics of disability. Like, I am not able to say what I want to say. And I have to go through this lengthy, grueling, kind of facilitated process. Often in my own writing process, it involves a lot of movement. I have to get up and walk around, and I have to contort my body in various ways. And all to bring something to expression. I have to find that shape of enthusiasm, that form in my body that the feeling wants to take. And then out of that, the language is able to take shape. And then I'm able to type it into words that other people could read. So what I'd like to do is this. And I'd like each of us to get up or move in some way. Move in whatever way allows a feeling to take shape, a line of thought to emerge, and then to type it into the chat box. We have a chat box here on Zoom. And then I want to allow us a moment to read each other's lines and then see if we could carry the whole field, as it were. So get up again, a sort of repetition, carry all of that, and then come back with a line. And I'm not sure what happens after that. I would just like to see what might emerge in our typing from carrying a feeling in our movement. First, like what we have, maybe what we might sense ourselves, and then second, what we might sense with each other. And I see two Dougs from different perspectives. That's kind of, is this the moment for skipping?
I'm unable to type on my phone, so I'm switching to laptop.
Okay.
Sorry for the confusion.
Okay, that's right. Does that make sense?
Not a lot.
Okay.
One thing, my feelings, I have to write, and then I can type. This is my process. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really, to carry a feeling across in my own process. And then there's the group subject. How do you carry the feeling across for a group subject? I'm working at the conceptual level.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this is your intention, is I have the experience of disability. Okay? And then what happens? I think that's your language. And I can sort of figure out what that could be for myself, but it would be language very differently. So for me to get to find the size and the shape of a group subject that is non-totalitarian, I think it's going to be, we have to chunk this down and much more slowly. For me personally, I feel my whole torso is in a knot. My stomach is in a knot. My pelvis is clenched. I'm having a hard time breathing. And I'm like, a group of people running from a tornado. And we're desperately all trying to get into a little tight space underneath the house so that we don't all get swept away. So this is why I think we need to be very careful. I'm not interested in contaminating the space with my disability. I do, however, want to sponsor myself and others in bringing forward differences that make a difference. And I'm sure each one of us has another metaphor that they could come up with that will be compelling for their experience of when they get stuck or when they have a disability or when they can't put it into words. But I feel, and I apologize ahead of time. I'm still working, I'm working conceptually, but I'm also working metaphorically. Mm-hmm. That this feels, and I'm not, this is not a criticism, Marco, because I love you dearly. I hope you feel that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is producing in me exactly what I think autistic people often feel. It's this neoliberal, let's get it together and make this happen kind of thing. And it's chunking too high. It's chunking way too high up in the, it's conceptual and it's frames and it's, so I'm using my body here. It's like all these rigidly held concepts that are going like this. Mm-hmm. My body is going. And this is not what I want to have happen. So it's sort of like, this is, I'm sort of re-traumatizing myself for the benefit, I hope, of our learning experience here. But my feeling is, it's about chunking down and chunking slowly. Because I'm not ready to type. I can barely take a breath. You see what I mean? This mm-hmm. is what's generating in me. It's not a sense of trust or openness or flow in a to bring forward a group subject. Mm-hmm. It's much more of a, I want to be alone. Mm-hmm. This is just my own personal feelings here. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge for myself and maybe for us is, how do we move from carrying across feelings as an individual to carrying across feelings as a group subject when we have no idea what's going on with that other person except for a handful of concepts that they've articulated. Mm-hmm. And they can talk about justice, love, nation states, capitalism, but who knows what the hell that's all about. Mm-hmm. And this is what we usually do. Mm-hmm. This is what we're trained to do. So I'm just bringing that out there. Hopefully, just this little bit of self-modeling I was doing with this tornado thing, I'm making explicit something that's usually not made explicit at all. Mm-hmm. Because I can certainly go into concept land and talk for hours. Mm-hmm. So can you. So can we all. That's what we all do very well. But what is this neoliberal depression that many of us are suffering from? I think this is an excellent example of what I think our author here is trying to bring forward out of her own personal experience. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I want to support you, but I want to support you in a way that I believe honors both of our integrity. Because if I'm just following instructions that you're giving me that I don't understand, mm-hmm. I'm finding myself like a test phobia in mm-hmm. school where they mm-hmm. say, okay, you got 5 minutes, you know, write this essay. Yeah. You know what I mean? And that's actually creating a block for me. Mm-hmm.
No, that's very good. I'm part of the state that I come into this conversation in is a sort of state of kind of frenetic movement because I have to leave in an hour and I was just reviewing the text and I just
don't want first to leave feeling traumatized.
Oh, right. I understand. Certainly, you know, it would be good to be in a calm, steady state when I leave here. But
go for it. I'm just letting you know what my objections are.
Oh, I understand. I actually don't think now we should do the exercise. I think we almost have done the exercise.
Okay.
In as much as, in a way, what I may have been unwittingly reenacting is a sort of chaosmodic state.
Yes, I agree.
And all a whole bunch of concepts, kind of disparate ideas that all tie together in some way, but they're like a hodgepodge. They're not carefully, you know, distinguished. They're not communicated, you know, with a clear purpose or a clear intent. It hasn't really emerged out of that. And so, well, what would be a clear intent?
What would you like to have happen when I have the experience of disability? What would you like to have happen? Hmm. Now we can go into a desired outcome, or we can go into a problem state. Either one of those are great to explore. This would be an example, I think, of chunking down, mm-hmm. or slowing the chunking down. But I think Doug, I just want to point out something, and then I'll shut up. But Doug, in an exchange that we had online, demonstrated for me that he was carrying forward a group subject. When I was presenting a difference that I had with somebody else in the forum and I was typing, I didn't feel like the difference I was making, not only was the difference not acknowledged, but the difference was ignored and then not just ignored, but attacked, but in a very polite way. So I was very frustrated, and Doug came in and he very expertly, I thought, went into the archive, previous comments that I had made that were complimentary, because I was feeling quite disabled. And he was bringing forward certain statements that I had made. And it was like something from heaven to hear my own language mirrored to me without a need for anybody else to understand it, agree with it, or disagree with it. He was just giving me back my own language. And I thanked him, and I'm thanking him now once again in public, because I think this is a very healthy trend. And I would like us to do more of that and do it even better, that we can help one another bring forward our differences in a creative way, rather than our differences becoming destabilizing and decohering us. Because I want us to move towards decoherence. That's why I so applaud Aaron for bringing up that I don't know if it's African diaspora, but anyway, the traumas that some of the African people suffered. And when the Western social workers came in, and instead of bringing them out into the sunlight where they can, you know, drum and dance and have these exotic rituals, they put them in dingy little rooms, dingy little conference rooms, and have one-to-one conversations. And they had to ask these social workers to leave. And this is what we as Westerners, in our neoliberal configurations, all of our helping is actually harming triggering these traumatic episodes, because depression is not inside me and it's not inside you. It's not, it's something that a group is holding. And also I think the gifts that the group can give, if it becomes a coherent one, it's a very different kind of treatment, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's great. I'm glad you're bringing all of this up, because I think it's very rejuvenating already, just getting all of this out on the table, our collective table here.
Mm-hmm. And we don't do it very often on this platform. We don't talk about the difficulties so much as we all sort of roll through our various sharings without necessarily bringing up some of the difficulties that may lie underneath. I think it's kind of interesting. And I thank you for, I think it's also an indication of the level of trust that does exist in the group that you can do that, John.
Absolutely.
One of the things I noticed is that I would have gone through your exercise, Marco, although, you know, as you say, I had no idea what I would do in terms of gesture or whatever, But I do think that one of the things that Johnny brings up is that the experience of carrying the feeling or the it's about specifics. It's about very concrete, specific states of mind. And the exercise you were proposing didn't necessarily get us to the concrete level. So even this is a very, very concrete expression of something going on, as opposed to some sort of general movement designed to elicit some sort of body reaction, which is, I think, what you were aiming for. It could have worked, but it's a different exercise, and I'm not sure that it quite corresponds to this idea of carrying the feeling, which I think is more about the specifics. I also think it's more about the singularity of each of us. Mm-hmm. So, and she talks about singularity in the chapter quite a lot. So in fact, she has does something very interesting with singularity, because I've been focused in my own interests on the singularity of the individual, but she also talks about the singularity in the collective, and the way the two link together. And that's a very unusual perspective. And I think this carrying the feeling is partly about that. It's the singular feeling that you're carrying, but you're carrying it in a way that engages the collective. Anyway, I'm not sure if I'm making any sense.
I'd like to respond if I can. I feel like we're all typing right now. So as Marco noticed, we're doing the exercise, whether it's on computer or not, on paper. I have at least 6 or 7 connective thought tissues that are forming, and I keep going back to the body session we had on fashion and how it's an expression, and I couldn't relate at all. And I saw the passionate exploration that you, Johnny, and Jeffrey were expressing about not necessarily just fashion, but that chapter in general and your experience with that. And I wanted to say that I one of the reasons I can't do tattoos or wear watches or even my clothing, it might be an expression of myself, or my hairstyle might be an expression, but I'm inside myself. I'm not a body to a certain extent. If I had my choice, I would remove the clothes. I would be in a nudist colony if my life allowed for that. But then beyond that, I would be in some sort of dark cave, maybe with my group of, or the world would be dark. Vision is not necessary for me, though it's extremely important. It's not a necessity to my core being. In the drawings that we did last time that you had us do, Johnny, which I wanted to share on the forum. I was going to yesterday, and everything got wet in the storm, as I mentioned. It was pretty powerful. My bag was completely soaked, but and I don't remember the order of the I, me, my, myself, and that, but I started out as a point, a nervous point that couldn't express myself, and I was branching out to other points, at sort of what you're saying, Jeffrey, about the singularity, trying to go out, maybe. But as the conversation progressed, I slowly became a body, and there was more forming around me. But I was still a point. I was still that point. And I like that. I think it was in the episode, the cafe that we did on suicide, Marco brought up our Slaughter Dive greeting, the parentheses that he had on depression. And I went and reread that, and it's beautiful. It's a great expression of depression, to where we're, and not this, it also might express my core being, which isn't depressive. It can be when in social situations, I suppose, but I start out at that point, and I've made it become, rather than a lonely, depressive spot for me, it's become, which we've talked about in other conversations, it's become the creative expression. So from, I go back to that point, not as a state of depression, but as a source for branching out. And my drawings seem to reflect that. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
I guess I would just like to say thank you to the four of you for being such gentle men. I don't really have anything to add. I read these two chapters pretty quickly because it's been a very busy week for me. But I have been really interested for a long time in the idea of reconceptualizing what we think of as a person, body, subject, identity. And if we think about something like a Borromean knot, which is a very concrete thing, I don't know if you know what it looks like, but I have a model of one I can show you if you'd like me to. As something spectral. And if we consider us, I've always felt very uncomfortable having worked in the field of disability my whole, actually since I was about 10 years old. The idea of a spectrum in multiple directions, almost like a star. So that rather than Doug's point of being a dot, it's a much more like a, not like a three-dimensional, I guess you'd say a star. And, you know, I guess what bothers me most is the us versus them mentality. Like, we are not artistic. We are neurotypical. I don't feel confident with that, those statements myself. I think we're all on, in a Deleuzean sense, a becoming, a changing, every day, every hour spectrum.
Can you repeat the name of the artist that you talked about a few weeks ago? That you went to the exhibit, but that expressing, once I viewed that, it was, yes, kind of that same, the mirrors, exactly, maybe infinite.
Exactly, yes. And I saw a documentary about her the other night that was astonishing, and I highly recommend it. It should be on Netflix soon. It's a 2018 production. Her name is Kazuma, and she's Japanese, and she's 85, and she has had mental health issues her entire life. And whether or not she does tiny dots and makes these amazing, like, whole walls are covered, are long pieces of like 30 meters of paper with meticulous dots and in various colors. And she sees the individual as a speck in infinity. So is this person obsessive compulsive? Is she manic depressive? She works 24 hours sometimes straight without stopping. Is she brilliant? She is now the most, you know, recognized and I think the wealthiest female artist in the world. And she lives in Japan in a psychiatric hospital where she has a studio where she goes to work. I think she has one assistant. It's absolutely an amazing film. And it so resonates both with Aaron's book and with our discussions. So
I think there's
Pat, thank you for your blessing that you bestowed on all of the gentlemen here. I really felt that. Thank you.
Well, I meant it in the terms of, you know, not the social role. I meant it in terms of being gentle people.
Yes, I got it. Thank you.
Could you come back to the knot that you started with?
Sure. I'll just go and get it.
Yeah.
And I should mention that after my catastrophic head injury, this was sent to me by my colleagues when I was still in the hospital, because I was, that was about 10 years ago when I was starting to think of a way not to think of individuals or kids with disabilities or whatever as Venn diagrams with circles overlapping, but much more moving. And that was before I read Deleuze. So who get it?
Sounds great. Sounds like some more topological psychology is starting to emerge.
I've seen, I think I've seen the documentary that she's referring to, and I think there's a clip of it somewhere on the site.
I've heard of that artist. I've heard of her.
Yeah, this is called a Baromian knot. And Jeffrey, as a physicist, you might want to Google this, because it is, it just shows the interconnection, and there are borders, but they're all permeable. And if you think about the human being, either in temporal terms, social terms, political terms, or anything else, this knot is very helpful because it gives you both space and boundary. You don't feel that there is nothing there. There is a thing here.
And porosity and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Dimensionality.
So I did look up the history of the Baromian knot at one point, and it's a mathematical term, but I can't remember the details. But it's Borromean. Yeah. Pretty nice present, isn't it?
Beautiful.
Having a moment of deja vu, because we had a previous call where another guest, Lisa Murawski, showed us a similar, not a knot, but another topological figure, a Klein bottle.
Yes.
And she also had a crystal that refracts light in multiple directions, kind of like a star. I'd like to maybe talk a bit more about this us-them between neurotypicals and the neurodiverse, or between the abled and the disabled. I feel like there's a lot of politics there that I'm not that conversant with, perhaps. And so I'm wary of stepping on anybody's toes or stepping on minefields, or, you know, there's a certain amount of just uncertainty and tension around even talking about it. And like, part of what struck me in this reading was that I felt that I could identify, but I felt that I shouldn't identify because there's still a difference. And then at the same time, there's a sort of deeper unity. And not identity exactly, but oneness, to put it in plain spiritual, mystical terms. So I don't know exactly how to navigate that. I just know that it's part of what's in the field, at least that I feel.
Can you give an example of a concrete situation where you have felt that? Like where you have wondered what to say or do? Or how?
Right now. there's this relation between the poetry and the audi-type. The audi-type is very poetic. It's very peculiar and beautiful. It has this peculiar beauty to it that I find in poetry that I like. And so I totally get that there's some deep connection overlap there. And it has something to do with the need to say as much as possible in as few words as possible, because there's such limited affordances for what you can say or the space in which to say it. the other, so there's these parallels, right? The facilitated communication is another parallel. Like what I think we're stumbling on here is a sort of self-facilitated communication of a group soul, group subjectivity. That's, I think, part of what John was pointing to.
Do you think that's possible? Like, what is group subjectivity?
There's a term in Quaker meetings about the gathered meeting, in which everyone's sitting there in silence. There might be the sounds outside or the babies cooing or whatever, but I do attend a Quaker meeting, and there was one weekend or one Sunday that everyone felt it was a gathered meeting when they left there. No one had spoken or given a kind of testimony or a quick speech, but there was some sort of sense there. It might have been my son was 3 at the time, and he was kind of just making kind of humming noises, trying to stay silent during the first few minutes before he went to the children's activities. There were songs beforehand, and maybe the musicality of that kind of tuned everybody in, or attunement sort of thing. So that's my perception of what a group, or
so that, the term now. That to me sounds like what psychologists would say. And I'm a sociologist / philosopher, I guess. But psychologists would call that emotional contagion. At least that's
a good term for it. And what was the term we were getting at?
Chaosmosis. That sounds like chaosmosis. And I don't know philosophically.
They're all similar. And just as, but a lot of us here, or at least in this field that we're talking about, don't like the psychological typical placement. Like that term sounds nice, but to place it in a manual and say, oh, well, you just experienced this, is kind of missing the point in a way, maybe, because there's that fluctuation and there's that. Anyways, I'll stop there.
Well, that I think is important, though. I mean, because there's emotional contagion, right? And I think that might be closer to chaosmosis, because it suggests something unruly, something uncontainable, irrepressible in some way that crosses the normal boundaries around an individual self. It kind of infects a group. But that could be a mob mentality, that could be genocide, that could be any, or it could be love. It could be, you know, a hug fest, right?
It could be the Sistine Chapel as well. It could be Mahler's Ninth Symphony, conducted by von Karajan with the Berliner Philharmonic. It could be Martha Graham. You know, these great artworks came out of emotional contagion.
Right. But so to call it emotional contagion and to put it in the discourse of psychoanalysis or of therapy as something to be corrected, something that shouldn't happen, is, you know, I think part of Deleuze's argument that that's a part of a power structure. It's part of
normophobia.
It's also part of Aaron's argument, because, well, I guess she's drawing on Deleuze, but it's this idea of switching from a neurotic perspective, which is very Freudian, to the schizoanalysis perspective, which it's the one part of the chapter that really took me to a different place. This idea of viewing the sort of psychological and social part of the world as being this movement between what did she call it? Spark and
petrification.
You know, it's such a poetic image, and yet it's such a true image as well. So, well, and often poetic images are true. So that, but anyway, it was something that really struck me when I was reading the text. The other thing I wanted to say is about this thing about disability. So I read this thing. It's on, I can't tell you the page numbers because it's on a Kindle and it doesn't follow the normal page numbers. So she says, this attention to the difference between the schizoid pole and the production of the schizophrenic as an individual is similar to the distinction I make between autism as a medical category and autistic perception. Now the key word that I picked out of that paragraph or phrase is the word production, because so she says the production of the schizophrenic as an individual. So in disability, in Quebec, we have a model, which is the model that determines policy and service and the way everybody thinks about disability here. But it's a modern model, as it's called the processus de production de l'handicap. So it's the disability creation process. But in French, it's the disability production process. So the idea is that society produces disability. Disability isn't in the individual. It's produced by the way the society works in relation to the environment and so forth. And Aaron's drawing on a similar idea here in relation to the schizophrenic. So the production of a schizophrenic, again, so when we talk about disability being produced, we're not saying there aren't impairments or functional limitations in certain people. Those things are in the are in relation to the person. But to turn the functional limitation into a disability, that's where the society comes into it. For just having a functional limitation wouldn't be a disability if you could do everything that you needed to do in your life and fully participate. In order, when you can't do that, then it's because society has gotten in the way and made things harder. So the disability idea comes from the interaction from society. And here she's talking about the production of a schizophrenic, again, not necessarily the experience of schizophrenia, but the way a person with schizophrenia is disenfranchised in the world. And the same thing for autism, right? So there's something I found really interesting in the parallel between these three things, schizophrenia, autism, and disability in a broader sense, and the process of production. And one of the thoughts I had, and it comes back to what you were talking about, Pat, is I've been thinking, well, if neurodiversity, because in a way, neurodiversity is this big, and neurotypicality is this big. I mean, it's this tiny, tiny region, and almost nobody is probably directly in it. If I take the idea of spectrum that Pat was talking about, we can talk about a neurodiverse spectrum, and the neurotypical is down on one end of that spectrum, and it's tiny. So the general, the natural range is neurodiverse. The same thing with ability. We tend to think of the world as most people in the world as being able-bodied, and this minority, which is, you know, the statistics shift a bit depending on what you look and how you define things, but 10 to 25% who are so-called disabled. But that's another problem with the spectrum, because the spectrum of ability is much, much wider than we generally give it credit. And those who are actually able-bodied is another small little fraction down on one end. And everybody else is in the middle with, you know, with one form or another of that we label away, in a sense. So I think, so in a way, I think we should be looking at the process of production of the neurotypical, because that's what's being produced by, in a sense, the disability and the, or the spectrum of ability, the spectrum of neurodiversity and the spectrum of mental health is the natural mode. And it's the narrowing of this field to a very, very small thing that is the artificially produced thing. And so we should be talking about the production of neurotypicality, the production of able body, the production, see what I mean? That's the artificial bit.
I think we could also say the production of genius. You know, what does it mean to be a genius? You know, the whole IQ charts, that's a whole other debate, but the idea of genius, whether we're talking about musical genius, physical genius in terms of being an Olympic runner, or I remember thinking this when my son was placed in a gifted class. And I remembered thinking, why are gifted classes not called special needs classes? And why are special needs classes called special needs when really they aim to afford children the rights to which Canadian children should be entitled? So, and what are gifted kids disabled? You know, that's taking my metaphor of a bursting star spectrum, kind of going against that, because I think there's kind of a circle, and maybe that's why I like the Borromean knot. Maybe there aren't quite enough layers here, but you know, my son ended up as a physicist, and I think he's on the autism spectrum disorder. I think I probably have some obsessive compulsive, you know, I guess what I'm saying here is, which scientist, which poet, which writer doesn't have obsessive compulsive tendencies? I hope you hear that I'm not trying in the slightest to be offensive, but I'm just trying to break down the barriers in my own understanding and how we think about, based on the Enlightenment subject, like that there is such a thing as an enclosed person that then can be put into a box, as Kangelham said, you know, if you put a person in any box, you're accusing them of having a stable positioning or characteristic. But it's scary to be where I am, because it feels that all the foundation of everything that I've learned and read about for my life could be wrong. And I think that's why I was so attracted to Erin's work, because she just does open up the possibility of thinking completely differently. So the world, my husband's just walked into the room. The World Cup, tell us what's happened, Gary.
Mexico.
Germany was eliminated by Korea.
What? Okay.
2-0.
Wow.
Mexico, Sweden go through.
So.
All right. I have to get going. I want to, and I'm going to listen. If I can, I'll call in and you'll just see, you won't see my face. So a couple loose threads for me. Doug spoke earlier about not being his body, about being a self sort of inside his body. Not inside your body exactly, but I don't know exactly. A point.
I'm a star. Everybody's a star. So.
Well, I just want to bring that, just loop back to that. And hold it, because it has something to do with the question of production, I think, and how we produce people, how we produce who we think people are.
Different question. How we produce what we think people are is a different question than how do we produce individuals or people.
Okay. Yeah, they're related, but different. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Marco, before you go, a proposal that we could, between now and our last section or our next session, we could work on some sort of process that honors that intention that you were formulating. I believe we would be doing service to one another and to Erin's work here. As she says, let this be our challenge to collectively create techniques to carry further the alignment to difference alive in an autistic perception. For me, autism and autistic are pretty synonymous in some ways. And I think this is something you are articulating true, Pat, about how many geniuses are so-called disabled people. And so many, what would have happened to Martin Luther King if he hadn't gotten depressed? You know, just give him some Prozac and he'll get over it. I mean, it seems to me, Erin's message about how effective depressives can be when they get together. So hopefully we can explore that more, Marco. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and that the last point I just wanted to make, not point exactly, but the question of activism, because that's really where the chapter ends up. And her critique of Bifo's, I guess, defeatism and with sort of advocacy of a withdrawal from the field of production, right? Of the production of ourselves. So I'll go now. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of the conversation.
Thank you, Marco.
Join me next time. Thank you.
If I can jump in on the last question he had, which I did go back and read the first part of it, and I understood it wasn't a complete disconnect between Erin's version of depression and what Bifo was saying. But I felt like they were on different wavelengths or not speaking about the same activisms. I took Bifo as expressing the, I feel, at least within this current political situation, I feel like the withdrawal is almost similar to what I talked about, going to a point and then reaching out for creative options. I posted on one of the threads when that strange fella came on, and I was kind of getting very antagonistic on the metamodern thread, which is a political sort of thread we have. But I posted the reaction, or in Germany, the reaction to the neo-Nazi rallies. Instead of protesting, they started a charity in which each meter that this neo-Nazi group went, there would be signs saying, "Thank you for supporting our charity for helping people get out of the mentality of neo-Nazism or that view." And as they progressed, they had snacks and with little comments on everything they were reading. And once they reached the very end of the march, there's a big banner saying, "Thank you, we reached our goal for our charity. We hope you go to our site," or something like that. But I felt that is more of what Bifo is getting at. This, rather than putting your life on the line, where here in the States, in the South, there was the recent Confederate statues that were removed, and there were lives lost because of protesting against these neo-Nazis, or maybe more conservative folk who felt the Confederate value should be held, which in my mind, it's okay to protest the removal of the statues, but there were the neoliberals protesting, the group protesting, and that's antagonistic. That's getting at the cause. I can't remember the word that he said, the phrase, but it's getting at I think it was replacing desire with duty. In a sense, these protesters against the protesters are responding with a duty to just protest rather than, I mean, they're full of passion, but there's no end goal to that. It's not like you can't end a person's perspective on life. You have to get to know the neo-Nazi on a direct level, which I've mentioned. I live next to people that wave the Confederate flag and are racist against blacks, but at the same time, I see them as human. And then Erin is getting at, which they parallel in a lot of ways, but she's getting at a different type of activism, which is what you were talking about, Pat, and a few of us have talked about, of maybe activating the field of neurodiversity or seeing stepping away from this neurotypical world. So I'll stop there because that was a confusion for me. Maybe somebody can explain. I don't know if what I said made sense.
I think it made a lot of sense. So I guess we're starting on, we worked on chapter 7, now we're going back to chapter 6, right? Because last time we didn't.
Sorry, I don't want to keep going with that chapter. That was just a...
But it seems to me both of these chapters and all these chapters blend together, and we're coming towards the end of the book, so I think there are considerable overlaps. But what I had planned to introduce this, or to continue with this chapter 6, because we'd already started it, and we had done that exercise. You weren't here, Pat, but we did an exercise working with the personal pronoun I and all the other pronouns. And we drew some pictures and we had a conversation generated around that. One of the things that I found really compelling, I just want to quote her. We've already touched on all of this already. It facilitates, she's talking about facilitation and co-facilitation and how can we learn how to learn from one another. If I learn how you learn and you learn how I learn, we can then learn even more as we start to shift our allegiance from I'm over here, you're over there, I'm teaching you something, you're going to teach me something. And rather than having a relationship to the field, which includes each of us, so if we can tune, and so my interest is in tuning to the field before we focus our attention on an individual. I find working with people with dementia and severe disabilities and virtually no memory, except autobiographical memory is gone, but episodic memory may still be there to some extent. Working with those persons, very intimate ways, I found if I could relate to the field before I tune into the individual, I am much more flexible. And so that was a big learning for me, having spent so much time in concept land and learning everything about schizophrenia except how to deal with a schizophrenic. I think so much of our conceptual factory model education is really about getting all the concepts organized. But then when we go out into the field, we don't know what to do because we're dealing with things that weren't in the manual. And I think that's what this book is all about. So I just want to do not the exercise that I plan to do, but another exercise that I think could illustrate some of this or to embody some of what I think is in this text and the previous conversations that we have been generating. I just wanted to backtrack a little bit because you were talking about that scary, it's scary where I am, Pat. Because I could be wrong. And there's also the Bromian knot. And I think you said spectral, or was it spectrum?
I use the word spectral because of
that. And And I'm just wondering about those borders and permeable. And you mentioned a kind of circle. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious.
I think they're actually a series of Mobius strips. You know that?
Yes.
I think that's what, I'll have to look it up later, but.
Yes. So I'm also aware of Douglas and the nervous point, and I'm inside myself and I'm not a body, and a nudist colony is where you would like to be. And you talked about your process and how that lonely depressive spot becomes a creative expression. And previously, Jeffrey was discussing production and how we produce disability and the spectrum of disability to able and genius and, genius and disability and the special needs of people who are highly gifted, and how we produce these very fragile categories. So anyway, for the rest of this conversation, I guess we have about 50 minutes, is that right? About 50 minutes? So just very briefly, I would just ask, just to go around the circle, I'd like to ask you all, for the rest of this session to be really useful for you, this session will be like what? Who would like to begin? Can I ask, Doug, can I work with you first, since you're familiar with my odd kind of questions? For this session, Doug, to be really useful for you, this session will be like what?
I like to keep going with how we're going, how we're moving. The spectral from Pat has made me realize I'm a ghost in a lot of ways. I know you, but you don't know me type of feeling. I can not fully read minds, but I can read time. I can read your time. I know you from the time I've spent with all of you, even if only on a Zoom or a few written words.
And keep going with how we're going, and spectral, Patchmark spectral. And I'm a ghost in a lot of ways. I know you, you don't know me. I can read your time. And when you are a ghost in a lot of ways, and I know you, and you don't know me, and I can read your time, what support do you need from our group? Or what resources do you have that you would like to develop further?
I guess you can help me become a body.
Help you become a body.
Develop my clothing for me. I don't necessarily need to be in a nudist colony. I just need the right type of clothing.
And help you become a body. And can that happen? Can you become a body?
I'm in the presence of designers, so yes.
Thank you. And can I ask you the same questions, Pat? Do you feel okay with this?
Yes, I do.
So for this session to be really useful for you, Pat, this session will be like what?
I'd rather not answer it would be like what. It sounds like you're asking for a metaphor to me.
I am, actually. That's okay.
I would like a close reading, a very close reading of one page of Aaron Manning. I also want to say that the ideas that I've expressed are certainly not mine, or only mine. And I would highly recommend a book by Brian Rotman, and it's called, it's very Deleuzian, but probably one of the very best books I've ever read, and it's called Becoming Beside Ourselves, published by Duke University Press. And I guess the other thing that would interest me is I think we are not attending to the new or the openings and understandings about the gene and epigenetics, if we want to go very kind of big, a big scale, but even at the level of what we call the individual. And that is partly because I'm having the magical experience of closely watching and being with three little girls and watching them develop language and be producing themselves and being produced by the social into what we call individuals. So I don't know if that's too many things, that's three things, but
that's great. So you said that I would like a very close reading of a page of the Aaron Manning's books. And you mentioned Brian Rotman's book, which I've read and I love. He's a genius.
I love the chapter on numbers, which I didn't ever think I would be mesmerized by. But anyway.
I totally agree. He's a great writer. And a magical experience in three little girls.
The genetic production of the person, and the epigenetic project.
And what kind of support do you need from our group?
Well, I don't think we can. I thought as a result of this four-way conversation, we would maybe arise at one way to spend the next. And I have to leave in about a half an hour. Okay. So.
Thank you. And Jeffrey, for the rest of the session, to be really useful for you, this session will be like what?
So I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say here, but I have a kind of a split personality. I've talked about it quite a lot recently. So I have this side of me that's very open to being, this kind of exercise where you're exploring in a structured way different things. And then I have another part of me that totally wants to reject it, close my computer and leave right now. so I'm having a lot of resistance to the exercise, even though, as I say, there's this other part that gets along with it fine. So a little bit like your, well, I don't know if it's the same thing as your at the beginning, but I do feel a bit like that right now. and the part the part that doesn't want to do this is, so it comes back, so Pat was talking about a close reading of one page of, so I think we could bring that into maybe the next time we meet, we could do that exercise. I also tend to, I feel a little bit frustrated when we move away from the text into these exercises. I want to, the text of Aaron Manning is so extraordinary that I feel the more time we spend as a group reading and thinking about what Aaron says, as opposed to these exercises, that's more useful to me. So I'm kind of answering your second question rather than the one that you asked me.
And a split personality. And open and reject. And a split personality. And what support do you need from the group?
So I already said I would like kind of like to not spend the whole next 30 minutes or so doing the structured exercise and go back to the text, but hey, I'm open to what the group decides.
Well, this exercise is over. Well, the intention here was just to, what does each person want? What support do they need? What do they need to be like? And that's information that we all now have out on the table.
And can you relate?
We can do whatever we want to do, but we know what other people want. It's been made explicit.
And can you relate the exercise to your understanding of what Manning's saying? Because that's a little bit, I have a little bit of a difficulty understanding why this exercise in relation to this text.
Well, okay, great. Facilitation. And what I am, I'm quoting Aaron now. So maybe we're starting to do the close reading. What I am suggesting is that poetry's inherent capacity to facilitate the creating of bridges between artistic perception and language is multiplied in autotype by a degree of facilitation that explicitly activates the relation necessary in making the transition from perception to words. This second degree of facilitation carries feeling across modes of expression. It facilitates the opening in language of affective tonality, making felt in the words what I have elsewhere called the pre-articulation of language in the making, the beneath of words. Let this be our challenge. I'm repeating what I repeated earlier, to collectively create techniques. This is the technique I've been using, to carry further the alignment to difference alive in the autistic perception. And previously, in another chapter, she talks about activism. Activism is not about the individual. At its best, it is how the collective operates as a group subject. So my intention is to tune into the field, the group subject. And yes, I need structure. I do not think you can do this in a safe way. People, if there's enough safety, people can go into the unpleasant zones, those liminal zones where they are schizo. And you can play with different parts and it can be harmonized with the group subject. So that was my intention. It didn't happen the way I wanted to because Marco had to leave early, so he went first. So I did an exercise that I wasn't, the exercise I just did with you guys is not the exercise I wanted to do. The one that I wanted to do, we don't have time to do. But like Aaron says, hey, you make plans and they fall apart, so you do something else. And believe me, I so relate to the schizophrenia, the schizo parts, because I would love to be by myself right now. There are a lot of things I can do on my own, and I feel very safe with those, with the me space. But I also know the subject, the group subject, will be, you know, I will never realize that, neither will any of us by ourselves. So that's where I think our new politics is starting to emerge as we become more intimate, create these more intimate zones where my metaphor and your metaphor and everyone's metaphor can be put out there. Not just the CEO's metaphor or who gets elected for president. I mean, that's why those people want those positions so they can create the metaphor, because the metaphors do create entailments. And that's where I think our new organizations, if they're going to have any life at all in them, are going to have to be able to be mature enough to allow each member to have their own metaphor. And that can change. And every metaphor we come up with is going to need another metaphor, because no metaphor is complete. And every metaphor obscures as much as it brings forward. So I think metaphorical thinking and poetics is all about feelings. What's that like? Coming up with a metaphor. And then putting that out in a public space. And then you have a relationship to the field that is much different than if you're just talking, let's talk about justice. Let's talk about neoliberalism. Let's talk about capitalism. let's come up with another concept about another concept about another concept, which is, I think we all know how to do pretty well. But I'm just wondering about the effectiveness of that kind of strategy when it's so disconnected from that, what I think is very healthy schizo. You know, it's like you feel this part over there and you feel this part over there. And if we can handle that in a kind of safe way, because it isn't like those schizo parts of us go away. They're still there and they're still operating, usually in very surreptitious ways. So let's let them come to the table and let's hear as many of these voices as we can so that we can create a new stability and a healthier kind of coherence than, you know, totalitarian regimes and the sort of fascist wave that's happening right now where people are hunkering down and overprotecting and getting very inflamed. Anyway, that's my big spiel. And I hope this generates some discussion about the rest of the time we have about this chapter, carrying feeling forward. Not carrying concepts forward, carrying feeling forward. And that relationship between, I doubt that we can separate concepts from our affects. I think there's a deep connection between concepts and that affective zone, those affective zones. Oh, so what happens next, guys?
So thanks for making that clear, John. I think that is clear for me. For one of the things I wanted to come back to, but again, I don't want to hog the floor either, but is this idea of facilitation? Because I get that Aaron is talking about it in a more general sense, but at some point in that text, either chapter 6 or 7, she talks about facilitation through touch. And this is, I think, in particular in relation to certain parts of autism where it's touching a person that gives them the possibility to move forward. So they're kind of stuck until a person touches them, and then the touch is what allows them to move forward. And I kind of feel sometimes that's a form of facilitation. That's a form of facilitation that speaks to me. There's another point where she talks about, and it's another thing, she talks about, so she's describing different people with autism and their way of dealing with the process of doing something. And she talks about a person with autism who rearranges objects on the table, in that allows a person to move forward because of the rearrangement. And because Erin has written a lot in this book and her other book, Relationscapes, about the role of movement, but I tended to think of movement as dance or walking or this, but rearranging objects on the table is also a kind of movement, and it's a very different kind of movement. And that's a kind of facilitation. So it's these subtle forms of facilitation that interest, that are part of what I find interesting in what she's talking about. And relate to my understanding of perhaps my own process in ways. Marco, when he was leaving, was talking about the need to move his body sometimes in order to write or do contortions with his body. Again, I think, you know, we've had the exchange online, Johnny, about the difficulties of writing and getting blocked and needing to back up and go forward. And moving the body or doing odd things is sometimes the way of, one of the ways of handling some of those things. So I think that's also relevant.
I just wanted to respond by saying the touch is very, and touch. And I used to teach Reiki, and I used to do a lot of energy sharing with people. And so I used a lot of touch at one time in my life. I stopped doing it because I was picking up on things and I didn't know how to handle them. And also people were having sort of visionary episodes, and they would articulate these experiences to me, and I didn't know what to do with that, because there was nothing in my handbook that described these kinds of phenomena. but I know how powerful touch is. And what I found as powerful for me is metaphor. For me, you can use your mind to touch. It's a non-kinesthetic touch. I don't have to reach out and grab you and, you know, for this touch. It's metaphorical. But I think that's where poetry comes in, that it we can use language to touch in very direct ways.
Yeah, I'm trying to touch you.
That's the spectral aspect, I guess.
This is our challenge online. We're using this technology. We're not in the same room. I could go up there and pat you on the back or give you a hug, and that would transmit all kinds of information. And rapport could be greatly heightened, or hold hands or whatever. As a group, we could do that. But how do we establish that on these online forums? And maybe a lot of our depression, neoliberal depression, and our alienation anxiety comes from the fact that we can't, you know? But I think that's why metaphor and story are so important, because those are, for me, forms of non-kinesthetic touch. But thank you for that.
Can I ask Pat what the page you liked, what happens to be, and maybe since there's no page number for Jeffrey, quote from the page so he can search it later. But if we don't get to it this time, it'd be nice to at least reflect on it, even if we don't get to it later, too.
We have time today, yeah.
I don't know if Pat has time, though.
Well, I'd be very interested in a close reading of from, it's on page 133, from agency to agencement. That's one example, but there were many that, you know, any one page, it would be, I've never had the privilege of doing a really close reading the way philosophers do. And I don't know whether we could do that, but.
Is there a page that you like the best that you could lead us in? If you would read it out loud and we could do it right now.
Well, there was a lot of reading here. I would have to think about it to find my favorite. I also feel that I'd love to talk about poetry. I mean, I also feel that in this group, we've been a little too hesitant to, at least I have, to be, to have the courage to be critical of Aaron and to say, well, gee, I disagree with that, or you know, and just about what you were just saying about touch. I mean, the phenomenologists, many would argue that seeing, I mean, the whole, you know, where is the brain, what is the person, I don't know the answer to these questions, but we do know that if a mother looks at her infant, she and the father, baby's father, have physiological changes that endorphins just flood through the body. And it's recently been shown that grandparents, especially grandmothers, but grandfathers as well, have the same physiological reaction just to seeing a baby. Their baby, their grandchild, and that could be online. So I think we need to give technology a bit of a break here. What do we mean by touch? What does it mean to be moved? I remember I taught a course about qualitative methods many, many years ago, and I had a physician in my class, and he was very interested in what he called the heart sink patient, and he said it was the kind of patient that none of the people, his partners, wanted to look after or care for, not because they were not nice people, but because when she walked in the door, their heart sank. They had the physiological feeling of their heart sinking. So, I mean, we could have a whole meeting just talking about what do we mean by being moved? What do we mean by moving? Or what does it mean to have been moved? How is an infant moved? I mean, you know, there's so much here. I feel that we're kind of surrounded by this amazing stimulation, and yet we get scattered into what seems to me a kind of a autobiographical or confessional mode about ourselves, which I'm with you, Jeffrey. I do miss the text, and that's really what I was saying by a one-page reading. So, but I think that's hard work.
I'd kind of like to, are you able to make the next meeting, Pat, on the 11th?
I'll just go and get my diary.
The last meeting of the series.
Do you think it would be possible to extend another week beyond?
Yeah, I think
I almost feel like this is not necessarily this group of people, but this concept that's coming through almost deserves a sort of grouping of its own. Maybe not a consistent one, but it's definitely one to revisit.
A closing meeting after the text. So we could do next week to finish the text and then do another meeting as a kind of closure bilan, kind of.
Yes, I should be able to come attend on the 11th. And then the next one after that is?
Would be, I don't know if it would be the next week, the 18th.
That should be okay too.
As a final meeting for the group.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is important is that the group changes every week. And now we're a very small group of the four of us. And we've kind of bared ourselves. And at the next one, there may be 9 people who weren't part of this conversation. So it often feels to me that there's a lot of kind of gaps and repeats that, and I don't know what the answer could be to that problem.
The recordings are posted on the site.
Yeah.
So several people, usually people who missed the session, go and watch the previous recordings. So they at least know what was discussed but the question I had for you, Pat, is would you be willing to pick out a page for the 11th and, you know,
if I could just email it to you. Like, I am not, I'm really not technologically very facile. So I could find a page in the last 2 chapters.
And
a page or two. I mean, has anybody ever done this close reading?
Yes. Pat, you know, we each have taken on the task of starting off framing a chapter. So maybe you'd like to frame the next chapter and do what you want to do. I would support you 100% in that.
Well, if I have time, my issue is, although I'm retired, I do have to really watch my my energy use, and I have a lot of commitments. So I'm not sure, because I do find this 2 hours is tiring, and it's a lot. So
I'm aware of that, Pat. I propose to lead the group, but if you could just pick out a passage, one or two pages, as you say.
Okay.
And then I don't mind leading the group. I'm quite aware of, you know, your own efforts and needs there. So that's why I haven't asked you to lead a group, in fact. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey. I would like to say one thing about it may sound narcissistic, but when I was in the ICU after my head injury, a very close friend of mine, a colleague from English literature, came to visit me, and I had this peculiar ability to have all of these bleeds in my brain, but I seemed, and I wasn't recording any memories, but I recognized everybody who came into my room. And when Elizabeth came, she brought some flowers and she put them under my nose. And I said, "The flowers sound beautiful." And I just find that really interesting when you think about what my brain did. I don't remember that. I have no knowledge, but Elizabeth remembers it. And I just think that the body-brain whatever it is we call a person is like a big black box. So that's what it feels like. But that's pretty cool that my brain kind of went like a filing cabinet there. Like it went to the senses, but it came up with sound rather than smell. So
sounds like a synesthesia. Yeah. Poets are very tend to do that quite a bit.
Yeah. So I'll do that, Jeffrey. I will look up, I'll find a paragraph. I don't know when it will be because we're very busy the rest of today and going to Montreal again on the weekend. So
you don't have to do it ahead of time. You can just come to the meeting with a passage picked out. And
I'll pick it out ahead of time.
Could I respond? Did someone else have something?
Go ahead.
I'm just remembering someone who studied shamanic healers. I think, I don't know, it was South America somewhere. But he said they all had, they were all of these different practices and practitioners, they had a pattern, he said. They had a intention to heal, a relationship, and a ritual. Mm-hmm. And I feel that for me, I'm also aware that like music isn't in the notes, a melody is in the relationship mm-hmm. between the notes. I think Aaron talks about this. I think that's where I'm getting it from. So music is relational. It's you and the first note and the last note create a sense of melody. And so when we're in these fields, I think that we are very musical in a way. We sort of have to intuit the whole through what's happening in each, through the, it comes through us. And I'm referencing something that Coralie said, who's not here today, but she was here last time. And you weren't here, Pat. I think you were on that train to Toronto or Montreal. But I think she brought up something that we sort of touched upon about how children have a genius, and all children have this genius. But something happens to it, and it goes away. And we were posing the question collectively, can we get that genius back? And is there a risk involved in getting that genius back? Earlier, and I think that schizo response, being open and yet being closed, that Jeffrey so well articulated, which I certainly respond to myself. And what you were speaking of, Pat, when you said about the confessional and the first person, and you wanted to get to the reading of the text, and Jeffrey wanted to get to the reading of the text. And in that genius that the child has and then loses, and the risk of getting it back, I don't have any answers here, but to me a healthy first person is not necessarily confessional. A healthy first person can be many things. But the text to me is a third person. It's something that aspires perhaps to objectivity in a way that a first person account can never be. And for me, what has been lost for me in the factory education that I received is a healthy first person. Doesn't mean the first person account is the right one. Certainly can be very wrong. But I think it's the relationship between those third person, let's stick to the text, and let's don't go into that so-called confessional mode, that I feel is a bit like, well, why can't we do both at the same time? Why do we have to choose one or the other? And I think there's an invitation here that, and I think as we've been doing today, we can do both. We can read the text, we can relate to it perhaps in a very idiosyncratic way, which is unique to each of us. And we can go back to the text And I think that flexibility is probably going to be very important, I think, for our learnings as we leave this group and go to other groups. And it's hopefully we learn something here, we can share it with other groups that we're members of.
Yeah. I guess one of the wonderments I have, and it really isn't a criticism, I don't think, but my question is about, is Aaron's book too autobiographical and too confessional, too much information? And I have felt that, and I don't know whether it's my, you know, intellectual academic self shutting her down, but I just wonder, that would be another area that I would like to talk about. Because I think she, in a way, epitomizes what we're talking about. She quite frequently in most chapters goes off into what I tend to find, and I don't know why, less interesting, where she's talking about her own depression or her own dance or her own art, which is quite an unusual in comparison to Brian Rotman, for example.
That was felt for me, especially in that last chapter on depression, was definitely self-focused, or the feeling was definitely of hers, was placed in there a bit too much for my taste. But I do desire sometimes just the objective. I want seven steps, like this is what she's talking about here, but a whole chapter on carrying the feeling, like, can it just be a couple sentences and explain it right there in front? And I felt that way with another reading we did on Sloterdijk, who could go literally 50 pages on maybe an artwork or one word even, and meander, and then finally, eventually you might get the concept. So yeah, I'm split, as we've all noticed here, between one end of the wedge and the other end, and meeting in the middle. And this, you mentioned the criticism, I guess we are being critical now, and I'd like to put this criticism on the table, just as I'm not an activist in any sense. I don't even necessarily consider myself an activist for, I like the Canadian phrase you use, but for those with mental disabilities, I participate. I'm there with Special Olympics, as they call it here, for activities, sports with individuals. I've worked with mentally disabled, and the going back to the facilitation, and that's part of what I don't like about the reading, is how many of us are going to actually interact with an autistic person in the next month? How many of us are actually going to be a facilitator?
All over the place in Manhattan, believe me. Autism and,
but for me here in Kentucky, unless I'm directly involved in the group, I'm not interacting. I see all those around me, even parents are putting their kids in facilities for other facilitators that will go home at the end of the day. And of course, everybody needs their alone time, but if a great idea comes to this autistic person in the middle of the night there, and they need that touch, who's going to be there for them if they don't have their family around anymore? So that for me is the disconnect between writing about it and actually doing something about it. And I'm aware Aaron Manning has done something about that with the Sense Lab. And so it's just another conflicting thought I have. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you for that. So chapter six, she does, I mean, what I like about chapter six is that you get a little bit of the feeling of what it might like to be autistic, or you at least are allowed to put yourselves in their shoes without necessarily fully understanding what is going on. And it changes your perspective a little bit. And I have a friend whose son is autistic. I just discovered this. I was talking about the chapter and this thing. And she got very interested and she said, well, my son is autistic. And while I'm, she said, while I'm émerveillé, while I'm fascinated and joyful about the complexity of that experience of her son, it's a challenge to deal with. And so understanding more what's going on, she saw that as being a huge plus. And so she asked me to send her the chapter, which I did. And, you know, it's philosophy. You know, I warned her. I said, I don't know whether the philosophy may bog you down a bit, you know, but she's very bright and has some background in some of the literature. So I think she'd probably do all right with it. But there's like an example on the practical side where the chapter spoke directly to somebody. So I'm not dealing with her son. She is, but there is a connection there that I thought was really interesting.
And as I progressed in the reading, I did make that connection that we do need not just hands-on, we need the actual literature, we need the actual political side of it to present. So say the 10 facilitators that work during the daytime at a location where there's autistic people and other disabled, mentally disabled folk, they don't view these people as other. And they need more, a lot. There's no training involved in these facilities, is what I'm saying. Similar to Johnny's experience with those with dementia. There's a little bit, there might be a video like, oh, well, this is maybe what they're feeling, but it's more of how to deal with the person rather than how they're feeling. So Aaron's work and the videos produced by actual autistic people explaining what's going on, like the wretches and jabberers that Marco mentioned, to actually have this as part of the core curriculum or hiring process of individuals going into these facilities as facilitators needs to be done. So I recognized that as I went along and said, well, you're not doing anything here, Aaron, you're just writing about it. Why aren't you there with somebody else? So anyways, that's how I think.
I'm sorry, guys, but I have to go now.
Thank you, Pat.
It was so wonderful having you.
Okay, we'll talk
soon. Bye-bye. In the sense that we have you.
you're also a gentle woman. Oh, shit.
Pat is one of my favorite people and has been for many years, and I spent all too little time with her. So having her play a role in this conversation has been extremely useful to me.
Yes, wonderful.
I wanted to ask her about her experience when she did have the injury, and she went on with the synesthesia type of account. Go ahead, John.
I know we have maybe 10 more minutes. I know this is probably not something anyone's going to want to do, but I have a question, and this may be for another session. Because I'm interested in technique. And if I had a criticism about Erin's work, she's anti-methodology, but she's pro-technique. And I find that a little confusing. I think that a metaphor that stabilizes is a model. I think a model is a metaphor. So, but what I'm doing, I'm looking for structure. I'm looking for that invisible architecture and making it explicit. And to me, you need to use language in a certain way to make that kind of possibility, that invisible architecture, to be made explicit. So this is my dilemma, is how to do this. So today and the last session and in other sessions here, I've done my best to try to create techniques. Not because I want to get bogged down in creating structure, but because that ritual, if you want to heal something, you need a ritual. There needs to be a practice, a structure so that you can hold these chaotic elements in a way that they can start to reorganize. I know when I was doing Reiki and doing a lot of healing art kind of stuff and doing a lot of touch, there was a pattern. And you do this. And you can, of course, change the pattern if you want to, but you miss things when you do that. There's something about doing something the same way each time, like a ritual does, that allows certain features to come forward into the field. And if you're changing around the parameters all the time, you just get a lot of noise. So that's my frustration as we're in this late stage capitalism, working with this new technology. The amount of noise that we're confronted with is just enormous.
I'd like to respond to that if I can.
Please, please.
But I really appreciate your exercises, your techniques. Personally, for me, they've really, along with the slaughtered eye greeting and other things on space, it's really honed in on a physical formation. Or I used to imagine the filing cabinets in my mind to where, as a technique to remember the text I was reading or anything, I'd say, okay, well, I'm going to, above my head, there's going to be this filing cabinet where I place this, and that way I can easily access all this information within my chaotic realm. That led me into materialist thinking and everything, but since the work we've done here, and even the metaphor just a minute ago, I'm being a ghost right now. I'm extracting moments of time I've experienced between all of you. And I'm going forward into the future, into our writer's underground conversation. Like, what? How do we carry this feeling we've had here, and how does that shape shift into the feeling we're going to place there, or the feeling of the cafe? It's a completely different feeling, but they're not different segments. Where we've got the time formations that have accumulated, and so I appreciate that, and I appreciate the individual accounts. I don't like the fact that 2 hours is never enough, because we never get past the individual stage. There was this presentation I did for one Quaker meeting on the holy moment, which is a concept from Awakening Life, one of the first posts I had here on the site. And there, this director is talking with another person, and the art of the movie, the movement of the scene, they're literally going like this throughout the whole time. It's an animated juxtaposition on top of actual conversation. And there's things that form as they say the word stars, and maybe stars will shoot out. But they're talking about how to reach that holy moment in cinema, and certain directors can do that. And I often come to a conversation, and in this presentation I did with the Quakers, like, how do we bypass those barriers? And we start out with our physical barriers. We had too much to eat and we have to go to the bathroom really bad. That goes into the psychological, like, I really don't like this person here in this conversation, or last time I was talking with this person, we had some beef, but we haven't gotten to clarify it. And we have all that baggage along with even spiritual, even that can be conflicted in like Reiki practice there. You pick up on things. Oftentimes in conversations when I'm speaking, which is a lot easier with fewer people, but if there's 10 people and I can see everybody there, and I'm not, even if I'm not looking, even if I'm blind to the visual, I can sense, even if everybody's on mute, I can sense something based on the past experiences of time and the amount of time I'm using. I'm feeling it now that I'm using too much time, so I'm going to stop soon. But it's nice. I really appreciated your conversation with Heather. I finally got around to reading, listening to that. And I feel like I'm Heather in a lot of ways, and that those feelings I can... I think you saw it too, John, so I'm okay with talking about it here, but I can articulate the feeling because I'm talking about the feeling, but to actually articulate the text, going back to what we were talking about, I can't remember a word I read of the Aaron Manning text, but I've got this headspace forming right now, and that's all I need to say.
Heather has a remarkable sense of the field. Mm-hmm. I feel like I could learn so much from the way.
Yeah, she's teach me to reconnect with that and expand upon my. Yeah, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Also have a great screensaver. I just wanted to show you guys that.
This may be a little off the wall. I know we're getting ready to wrap up, but you said this is sort of my response to the field. Oh, wow, that's intense.
Jeez, that is intense. I don't think I could manage it.
I'll post it later where it's from.
I know you, you said, Doug. I'm a ghost in a lot of ways. I know you. You don't know me. My response to that is, I think I do know you. And a split personality. I'm open, but I want to reject and close my laptop and leave. And I want to stick to the text.
That only happened because you allowed it to happen.
So I'm just very curious about that. Is there a relationship? And this is a huge question. It may not be useful. A split personality. Is there a relationship between that split personality and Aaron, or maybe it's Guattari, and that schizo analysis? Late-stage capitalism. I'm just curious, an open frame here. I just want to pursue that.
I don't know what the answer is.
I don't either.
I think the schizoanalysis is really interesting. I think these two ideas of petrification, is it, and spark, I think that is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
If she had to go through her own depression issues to get to that in the text, I'm tolerant, you know, because she did at the beginning of the text, she had this thing about the process of generating ideas through writing. And I think that's part of her process to get there. And it's certainly part of my own process through writing is my way of, you know, if I have an idea and I sense it's there, but I can't articulate it, I write a paper, you know, I start to write a paper and then it all comes together, you know, so, or a poem or whatever. But so I definitely like this schizoanalysis. I'm going to think about it more. But whether that's related to my split sense between wanting to be go with the flow or wanting to be off on my own and just with the text, you know, I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that.
Well, I hope each of us has found some support, and I certainly have been supported, and I very much appreciate that, because these are very difficult times we're living in, lots of turbulence, and the more I think we have groups that can create coherence, the better for everybody, because I can take the coherence that's been generated by our openness to the field, even the doubt and maybe confusion that may have emerged. I feel much more stable as I go out into the main streets of Manhattan, which is an epidemic of autism, believe me. Everyone's sitting there with their cell phones screaming at their secretary. So it's a challenge, but I feel buoyed up, you know, supported, that I'm not so alone in the world. And I feel that our depressions don't necessarily belong to us as individuals, as Aaron says, but belongs to the group subject. And many of us are going to manifest that in a different way. But I think we can, as many of our ancestors have, we can be very creative in finding the rituals or the therapies or the techniques that work.
Maybe the honeymoon is over between us, right? Because when we all started together, it was all, okay, you know, we take everybody's foibles and we work with them. And now the honeymoon is kind of almost over and we're starting to pick up on the foibles. Oh, I'm not sure I like this.
Throwing dishes at each other.
But it's good. It's healthy, I think. I'm profoundly convinced that the real connections, the real relationships are built on not just we agree, but we disagree, you know, and the disagreements are fundamental to building good relationships. So,
and they're interesting too. Are different.
Very interesting. Life's more exciting.
One more question. Are we meeting? Is the writing group tonight?
Yeah, the writing group is tonight. Yeah.
It's at 6, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Six, eight, our time, Eastern.
6 o'clock Mountain Time.
Yeah. 8 our time,
eight
Johnny.
8 o'clock Eastern Standard. Okay, great. Because I have some reading to do and some writing to do. So I have to focus my attention on that.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. See you next time.
It's been a good session.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Lots of fun. Thank you.